You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 3rd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Henry Giroux, author of many books on zombie politics and the age of casino capitalism. Also on the program today, CIA report expected to be passed through the Senate Intelligence Committee for declassification, specifically the conclusions and the summary. This will head to the president and the administration, and conveniently the CIA will get to determine whether or not it should be released to the public. Also on the program, more on that McCutcheon ruling yesterday. The most damning aspect is that it appears that this Supreme Court is headed to an outright deregulation of any of the campaign contributions to any race at any time, any limits. What's old is new again, or I guess you'd say what's, yeah, that's fair enough. Also on the program today, Koch brothers speak out, or one of them, and he's very, very angry at all of you. I'm so hurt. I came to Washington. Mr. Koch went to Washington. Also on the program, the Boy Scouts jettisoned a Boy Scout leader because he made an issue out of being gay. There you go, folks. All that and more on today's program. First off, obviously, big news yesterday, another shooting. This one, again, at Fort Hood. Four people dead, 16 wounded. An Iraq war veteran who was dealing with post-traumatic stress syndrome. He had a traumatic brain injury, was taking antidepressants. He had been under examination to determine whether he had had post-traumatic stress disorder. And apparently he just lost it. And frankly, you know, at this point, with what we put our military through in Iraq, I'm surprised we don't hear more of these stories, quite frankly. I mean, this is the third major attack at a U.S. military installation in 5 years, and frankly, I'm surprised we don't see more. But a sad day, of course, and somehow we will obviously talk about how the right wing is talking about this. This was inevitable with what President Obama did in Crimea, and the tremendous amount of gun-free zones that don't exactly happen to be on military bases. But, you know, this is par for the course now in this age of gun crazies, and also an age in which, you know, we subjected military personnel to just a relentless deployments over the course of 8 to 10 years. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Henry Giroux. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome the Global TV Network Chair Professorship at McMaster University and a distinguishing visiting professor at Ryerson University, author of tens of books, including Zombie Politics and the Age of Casino Capitalism. Henry Giroux, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Sam.
Now, I want to start with something that is, and we use the term neoliberalism on this program quite a bit, but I want to start with just you providing us a definition of what neoliberalism is before we dig into its implications in our society.
Well, I think if you want to get a short version, probably the best thing to begin with is to argue that it's an economic and political policy or even a project that really takes on a number of assumptions. One is that there's no such thing as the common good, that market values provide the template for governing all of social life, not just the economy. Consumerism is the only obligation of citizenship. A survival of the fittest ethic should govern how we think and behave. That public goods should be transferred to private interest. That unions should be dismantled. That basically militaristic values should trump democratic values, the welfare state is the archenemy of freedom, and that private values basically should be safeguarded while public values should wane. I mean, I think that's those elements basically speak to its basic parameters.
And so using that as the jumping off point, I mean, you write about a civic literacy that sort of permeates, I guess, our society now. Talk about what that means and how that dovetails with that.
Well, I think that what it means is that the American society has basically, the United States has devolved to a point since the 1980s where we see two major assumptions at work that promote, that view ignorance as actually not a liability, but as a gift for politics in general. I mean, one is the assumption that government is basically the cause of all problems and that there's no such thing as society, that people are basically on their own, regardless of the circumstances in which they find themselves. And the best way to understand this is to recognize that the last thing that we need in the United States under these right-wing extremists who now govern, basically govern all commanding institutions, are people who have a civic imagination, that people who believe in the public good, who believe in public values, who believe that public life actually matters, that government can actually work in some cases for the benefit of everyone and not simply for the benefit of a very few, limited 1%. So I think this question of civic literacy has really become quite dangerous. And where you see it, the attack most pronounced, clearly, is on public and higher education. I mean, public education in the United States is under such assault right now. I mean, all the major parties basically believe that public schools should be private schools. They should be turned over to charters, that the only thing that really matters in those schools are instrumental interest metrics, making kids basically stupid and dumb by leading them to believe that all they have to do is memorize bits of information that later become worthless. And then you have the attack on higher education. I mean, increasingly you have it being defunded. You have an attack on faculty. You have governance models that are basically business models. I mean, look what's happening at the University of Southern Maine. Look what's happening at universities all across the country in which the liberal arts are being completely defunded and in some cases actually dismantled.
And I mean, what's how much of that agenda, when we talk about this defunding of public education, the attempts to privatize? I mean, we have a governor in this state who literally upon signing or I guess completing budget negotiations said that it was the function of the state to protect the charter movement.
That's pretty funny, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny if it wasn't so sad. But
that's so tragic. I mean, it's funny only in the sense that it's a perfect example of the kind of civic illiteracy that now parades as acting in the interest of people in general. I mean, when he says the function of government is to protect charters, I mean, what he's really saying is the function of government is to protect the 1%, is to protect the hedge fund managers and the Bill Gates and the billionaires clubs, who are basically investing billions of money into destroying a public school system, into transforming higher education into simply a form of training. I mean, that's basically what he's saying. Well, the role of government actually is not to protect the 1%. I'm sorry. The role of the government is actually to do the best that it can for everybody in society. And so what he makes very clear in that statement, which he assumes is a matter of common sense, is that government is now basically controlled by economic interests, such as the Koch brothers and others who, for the most part, could care less about democracy and basically see it more as a threat than as a productive force for American society.
When we see these type, I mean, you know, I can at least comprehend the motives behind a guy like Governor Cuomo to say this, because he's gotten a tremendous amount of campaign resources from these people who are pushing this agenda. When we talk about the so-called education reformers, the agenda there is it part simply because this is their project to reap profits? Is it that they come from a culture that values only that which ultimately leads to profits, and they want to impose that on others? Is it that they also benefit from the notion of this civic illiteracy?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, I think you can't ignore the material interest and the powerful political and economic interest that now drive American politics. I mean, let's be honest. People aren't responding to basically the American people and what their needs are. These politicians are basically responding to lobbyists, and they're responding to people who are going to finance their campaigns. And I think I think the economic interest cannot be ignored. But I think the other side of this is that the question of civic illiteracy is something that now becomes a weapon. It becomes a tool. It becomes an ideological tool in basically convincing people that they should operate not in their own interest, but in the interest of the rich and the infamous. And I think that what you see now are politicians, particularly liberal and right-wing politicians, selling out any vestige of ethical and social responsibility in ways that is just shameful, not to mention the culture of cruelty and suffering and all kinds of hardships that they impose on people.
It's interesting because the paradox is, I mean, you say that, you know, that voters or citizens are operating against their own best interests, yet simultaneously we have this phenomena that you write about quite a bit, this notion of individualizing the social. And
right.
It's a question that I ask, you know, we have people come on who have traveled across the country, written books about people who found themselves in dire economic straits following the financial crisis and just in general. And the question that I always ask them is that, do these people see that what has happened to them in terms of their own personal financial crises as being a function of their own mistakes, or do they see it as part of the sort of, I guess, the naturally accruing from what we have systemically?
I think the first answer is makes much more sense to me. I mean, what we have now in this country is what C. Wright Mills called the foundation for authoritarianism, in that public values now collapse into private interests. What does that mean? It means that people no longer have a language of community. They no longer have a language of democracy. They no longer have a way of translating private problems into larger social issues. They can't make the link. And so what they often do is they blame themselves. I mean, the language of freedom has been so subverted in the United States by this market-driven fundamentalism. Is, you know, freedom is the freedom from not being infringed upon. Freedom is the freedom to take responsibility entirely for yourself, regardless of whether the problems that you're facing are not caused by you. Freedom is functioning in such a way as to disparage any kind of social dependency or to any notion of care for the other. And I think people are so trapped in that logic because it's been going on since Reagan. I mean, it's drilled in every day in talk radio, 95% of which are conservatives. It's drilled in the media. I mean, nobody talks about communal relationships anymore. Nobody talks about solidarity. And here you have, I mean, it's painful to listen, to watch some of these news programs interviewing people who have lost their houses. And these people all of a sudden start crying, and they say things like, you know, I no longer feel like a good father. I've failed my family. Damn, they haven't failed their family. The financial bankers have failed their family. I mean, that's what we need to understand, that these problems are systemic. I think the other side of that, relating to the second question that you raised, and this is really dangerous, is that notion that we are ultimately only responsible for the problems that we face has now become so normalized, has now become such a matter of common sense, that you rarely see problems taken up in a larger historical, political, and economic context. You know, these problems are just fragmented. You know, we have no way of connecting them. We have no way of connecting the defunding of higher education, for instance, to a neoliberal market-driven ideology that is just shifting money away from everybody else to the 1%. We don't make the connection.
I mean, I want to talk about that connection, but what do you think has accounted for this? I mean, not just politically, I mean, but also culturally.
I'll tell you exactly what I think is accounted for, and I think it speaks badly to the left. And I think what's accounted for it is that we have not taken seriously the educative nature of politics. Education is not just something that goes on in schools. It's central to the very concept of politics itself, because it raises the question, how do you change people's ideas? You know, how do you, in fact, make something meaningful, to make it critical, to make it transformative? And what we tend to believe, or what the left has believed for the longest time, is that basically economic crisis will offer certain kinds of political guarantees. Well, that's just not true. I mean, we have an economic crisis, but it's not matched by a crisis of ideas. And consequently, what we now have and what we've seen in the last, since the 1970s, is a right in it for all of its fragmentation has taken very seriously the culture war, and has taken very seriously what it means to basically change the needs, the ideologies, the education that people get to support the interest of very few people. We see it in the foundations. We see it in the attack on public education. We see it in the attack on higher education. We see it in a system in which a market economy now becomes equated with a market society, and people buy this crap. And they buy it because there basically are so few alternative spheres and so few social movements really taking up this issue that basically we've lost the war over ideology.
I mean, this notion of, you know, the market economy sort of becoming and we've mutated into sort of a market society is really at the nub of this on some level. And I wonder, I mean, you know, we talk about the agenda of the right and how they've carried it out in many respects. And it dovetails nicely with that sort of whole concept of it being a market. I mean, there's a lot of money floating around on the right that that I guess incentivizes these cultural changes. I mean, how does it happen in the absence when money becomes ascendant value in our society, as I think it has, particularly over the past 30 years? And how do you fight that? Because it's money that fuels the sort of, the cultural perspective that money is all important.
I mean, that's an educational issue and not just a political issue. I mean, I think that, look, you know, what needs to be reclaimed in the United States and taken very seriously is that we're basically moving into an authoritarian society, that we have lost any sense of democracy, the formative culture that supports that democracy, and the institutions that make it possible. And I think that what needs to happen is we need mass social movements that basically are going to get beyond their fragmentation, take on the question of radical democracy and its reclamation and what it needs to reclaim this, and organize and begin the long march that needs to fight this battle. And this battle has to be fought on the level of ideas. Do you want to live in a fascist society or do you want to live in a democratic society? You know, a market society is not a democracy. It's not a democracy. And in fact, it may be one of the most anti-democratic forces we have seen in 50 years to undermine democracy. This is the kind of language that we need to in some way instill. We need to go back to the social contract. We need to talk about the social contract and what it means and how a society cannot exist simply composed of rabid individuals who basically mimic some notion of reality TV in which there's only one person left on the island. We also need to make power visible. I mean, bad politics functions by making power invisible unless it becomes so arrogant and so obviously indebted to its own indulgence that it doesn't care anymore. That's the scariest part to me, because what we now have in all over the world is we have power separated from politics. Power is global. It floats. It doesn't care about nation states anymore. I mean, when you look at the European Union and these laws that are now being imposed on governments in which they can't control their own economies, that's an issue of power floating, financial power. It'll punish any state that it wants to by using these kinds of aggressive methods. So we have to rethink, what does democracy mean in the global age? How do we refashion it? This has to be a massive educational movement. I mean, thank God for alternative radio. I mean, thank God for alternative media. For the first time, you know, we have young people who all of a sudden now are getting access to information that they can't get in the universities anymore, that they can't get in school. And people are starting to wake up. They're starting to realize that, for instance, austerity is really an ideological weapon. It's not merely an economic policy, and that they're bearing the brunt of that.
And you know, you write in terms of making, you know, power visible, you write that we have fallen prey to a new kind of illiteracy, which the distinction between illusion and reality is lost. The ability to experience our feelings of discontent and our fears of uncertainty are reduced to private troubles, paralyzing us as seen in resentment, waiting to be manipulated by extremists. And you talk about it's not just that we've become a society of the spectacle. You know, I read that, and I've done a decent amount of reading of the Situationists and Guy Debord, and I'm curious as to what you see in terms of a society of the spectacle, what that means, and how it makes power invisible.
I mean, I think, Sam, that what it does, a society that begins to govern itself by spectacles is a society that governs itself by diversions. And I think you see it in celebrity culture. you see it in a media in which violence has now become the ultimate form of pleasure and entertainment. You see it in a society in which that is militarized at almost every level. And so, you know, we're constantly subjected to national parades, heroic sort of images of warriors. I mean, what we don't see in light of these spectacles, whether they, and of course you have the massive notion, massive advertising industry of consumerism, which really is a depoliticizing institution, right? I mean, it just basically says that citizenship is really about shopping and nothing more. I mean, what you begin to see is this massive cultural apparatus at work that is constantly attempting to shape needs, desires, identities, and subjectivities in ways that depoliticize them and trivialize them, and actually then function in the name of simply claiming that all they're doing is entertaining them, when in fact they're really educating them. These are education machines. I mean, these are what I call disimagination machines. You know, they rob the imagination of any viability, of any strength, of any hope.
I mean, what accounts for the rise of, when we talk about sort of that commodification of our feelings, the depoliticization of people? Was there something in American society 30 or 40 years ago that simply there was a certain inevitability? I mean,
I mean, this is about politics. I mean, what happened in the 1970s, late 1970s, and then really happened in 1980 is you got Reagan. I mean, and then you had the long march, death march, towards the death march regarding the dismantling of democracy. I mean, this is a very systemic, and it seems to me, organized movement that can be traced and documented. Look, I'll give you one example, Sam. Look, in the 1970s, you have the emergence of the Powell Memo, where the later Supreme Court Justice, who was then working for the Chamber of Commerce, put out a memo in which he said, hey, look, we really have to do something about the 60s. We have to do something about the universities. We have to do something about creating intellectuals that basically will support market fundamentalism. And that's when it begins. And what begins is a full-fledged economic, political, and cultural war against a generation for which there was such fear over what they were saying about democracy and about the university, and the fact that, as Christopher Newfield has written, all of a sudden you have a multiracial generations of young people coming into the university. It really scared the devil out of them. I mean, they were so threatened by this. They just could not believe that a public sphere could no longer be white and ruled by the financial elite, and that the market system could actually be called into question and made accountable for its abuses. And so we have seen a systemic attempt in since that time to really wipe out all vestiges of democracy and the institutions and the public spheres that basically support them. And we now find ourselves at the end point of that movement. I mean, it's really, for me personally, and I may be terribly wrong, but, you know, to call the United States a democracy anymore is like claiming that Walt Disney wasn't an FBI agent.
Do you think they imagined, though, the level of success? I mean, they had bridged that notion of what we will do in terms of political power will also so depoliticize the population that they won't even be able to sort of draw that line between what's happening to them as individuals and what this long-term project has been?
I don't think that it's a conspiracy theory to that degree. I mean, I think the historical conjuncture, a different number of elements came together around deregulation, privatization, the enormous inequality and wealth and power that came together with, taking control of the commanding institutions and cultural apparatuses of society that eventually led to that. I mean, it didn't happen overnight. It was a long process. And you can follow that process, and you can really follow it by looking at the way in which what happens to public education and the tax base from the late 1970s on. I mean, this attack on government and the notion that government is really the problem and not the solution, and hence, you know, we have to do everything we can to, you know, to sort of drown it in the bathroom, in the tub, you know, as one prominent right winger said, really marks the beginning of an assault that, A, the left was not ready for and didn't have the resources for, but also didn't understand the educative nature of the politics that was now being mobilized, this educative machinery of civic and social death that was being put into place. They had no idea. I mean, they got so caught up in specific issues that it became very difficult for them to address the larger issues, which the right was doing. I mean, you have to ask yourself, you know, since the 1980s, how has the right been so successful in bringing so many groups together under its umbrella that it basically creates a huge and powerful organization that begins to run over most of the important civic and democratic institutions in the United States?
I mean, my answer would be a massive amounts of money.
No, there's no question. There's no question whatsoever that money is at the heart of this. But at the same time, it's not just an economic issue.
It's not an economic issue that we're facing, but that to me seems so much the driver. And then the question just becomes, will that neoliberal movement sort of become a victim of its own success, I guess, is really the question, right? I mean, we see...
It's not a victim. If you want to talk about victims, you want to look at the people who have lost their homes, the people who are in poverty, the people who no longer have food stamps, they're the victims. I mean, I think that what it's become so successful that it's become insane. It's become so arrogant and so flush with power. And now its inability to actually even control its most right-wing elements, they don't see themselves as basically being as successful as they want to be. I mean, I think that when you look at the Ted Cruz's of the world and some of these other lunatics, I mean, believe me, they will find themselves, they will feel very successful when they have stamped out all vestiges of democracy. You know, why do you think Lindsey Graham talks about the United States as a war zone? I mean, you know, I mean, when he says we're all potential terrorists, you know, I mean, when you have a country that condones torture and all of a sudden blinks in the face of a massive surveillance state that makes the Stasi's dream about what we're doing, former members of the Stasi in East Germany. I mean, you know, believe me, they're on a roll. And that's what's so scary. I mean, the real question is, how do you stop this? You know, where do you want to begin to stop this? I mean, you know, what kind of political language? The Occupy movement had some sense of this. You know, I mean, they understood that, you know, inequality was really one of the tools at the heart of this, that power wasn't benign, that we're really dealing with very specific political extremists and movements, and that we need to address this. And they recognized that they couldn't address it within the language of liberal reform, that liberal discourse doesn't work anymore. I mean, liberal discourse is not as bad, of course, as right-wing discourse, but believe me, it's complicit. That's for sure.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that. I mean, how do you think that for those that see liberal discourse, the notion of reform? I mean, do you think that from a strategic or a tactical standpoint that it would be better not to have any liberal reform going on, or is this really more of a question of education and language?
No. I mean, the immediacy of the suffering that people basically are experiencing now does not mean that I would be one to say, you know, we can't reform Social Security for the better or provide food stamps for children who basically are hungry. That's silly. What we have to recognize is those reforms are not the end point. I'll give you an example of how this works, and maybe you can tell me if I'm off base here. Look, you know, you get a lot of people saying we should put those people who caused the financial crisis in prison, right? That's a liberal argument. You know, my argument is, we can put them in prison. They should be held responsible for what they did. But we need to reform, change the system that produced them. That's a radical reform. That's what's different. You know, I mean, I don't want to just put people in prison. I want to change the system. I mean, I we can't allow the system to continue. You know, we can't allow a system controlled entirely by money. It just doesn't work. And so I think the issue here is that as far as tactics go, yeah, we can get a third party. We can constantly fight to improve the quality of life for those who are marginalized by race, class, and poverty. But in the end, it's not reform we're after. In the end, it's radical change. in the end, we need a new kind of, a new understanding of democracy, and we need to fight for it. And it's not one that exists within the discourse, the policies, the institutions, or the visions of the two existing political parties.
So, I mean, how does that grow? I mean, obviously, I mean, one of the you know, and I think there's some evidence that at least, you know, the younger generation, when you talk about people under the age of 35, there's certainly, I mean, if you look at some, you know, the polling, they're certainly more open. And
yes,
they're, and probably for reasons because they're the ones who are suffering the brunt of this, you know, in terms of an age cohort the most, right? I mean, I think I've heard of you talk of them as I know you didn't coin this phrase, but the zero generation. Talk about that idea and how, and if you think it's going to emanate out of those people.
Yeah, no, you're right, Sam. I mean, my friend Zygmunt Bauman coined that term. And what he meant by that, he said a generation with zero hopes, zero future, zero work, and basically zero time. And this is the first time in history that we have an entire generation being condemned in ways that we are unimaginable, who have no sense, who have a future that looks hopeless for them, who don't have jobs, who are basically dying in debt, who for the most part have been abandoned by a previous generation that refuses to invest in them in ways to provide the conditions for them to have a better future than their parents. And I think that they're realizing that, you know, that politics is crucial. It's important. I mean, the more I talk to young people, the more I study the Occupy movement. I mean, the Occupy movement, people say, is that it's not dead. It's just been reconfigured. Now it works locally. I mean, because it doesn't occupy a particular place doesn't mean it's not around. I mean, you just go to their websites. They're publishing, they're writing, and they're trying to build a larger movement that will be sustainable. And I think that whatever change is going to come is going to come from that generation, because they're either going to mobilize and change the system, or they're going to be basically one of its worst victims.
I mean, do we need institutions that exist for that type of movement to congeal?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I write so much about higher education and write about other public spheres that matter. Ideas matter, but ideas tend to evaporate and get emptied out when you don't have institutions that support them. You've got to have institutions. You've got to have an infrastructure. You've got to have organization. I'm not interested in simply demonstrations. They don't go far enough. You know, you need to think in terms of long-term tactics, and you need to build alternative educational sites. You need to build alternative media. You know, you need to build places where young people can congregate and begin to talk to each other. You need public spheres that basically support those ideas and invite that kind of thoughtfulness, along with the democratic social relations that would make it possible. You need institutions that promote new kinds of alliances.
I mean, I think
new understanding of the commons.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, I mean, from my perspective, and we were down at Zuccotti Park a decent amount, a couple of years ago. That was one of, you know, that was one of the most successful, tactics by the sort of the reactionary forces was to the actual locality, the actual occupations themselves provided, it seemed to me, at least some notion of an institution where what you're talking about was happening. And
no, I think that's really smart. I think that ideas matter, but they matter even more when they're concretized. They matter when we have some sort of visible understanding of what they mean in terms of the social relationships they produce and the kinds of cooperative understanding and movements that emerge out of them. You're absolutely right. I mean, when you see young people feeding other young people or feeding the poor or offering free health care or you know, going helping those people who basically were the victims of Hurricane Sandy, boy, that speaks to something meaningful in people. I mean, it first of all, it destroys all the prejudices and stereotypes about how young people are lazy, spoiled, and all that nonsense that we see coming out of Time magazine and a number of other places. It makes people understand that this is a generation that really does care. I mean, it's a generation that's trying hard. It's a generation caught up in the dictates of survival. It's trying to survive. You know, it has very little time for joy and for basically being able to enjoy itself and to think about a future in which the imagination matters. That's the great crime here. I mean, I think that, for instance, when we talk about debt and young people, then the question of debt is not just about economic hardships. It's about destroying the imagination. You know, placing people in a position where they no longer even have time to be able to think otherwise in order to act otherwise.
I mean, in many respects, I mean, that's the sort of the converse, right, of what happened during the 60s. I mean, when you had people going to universities with a notion, having seen that there was some type of stability in probably their own families in a broad middle class, this notion of I now have time to sort of contemplate broader and more political issues and social issues. We're sort of living in the converse time in some ways.
No, absolutely. I'm with you. I mean, I don't think we understand enough the threat the 60s posed to the right and the way in which that legacy has been fought on multiple levels since that period in history.
And so what, I mean, it, you know, knowing that we know that in the event of a series of occupations, we're going to see everything from a local response, violent response, frankly, and coordinated, you know, at least to some degree with federal agencies, knowing that we're looking at universities which are slowly defunding themselves, at least, you know, state universities, you know, in order to provide tax cuts for the wealthy. I mean, where do those institutions come from?
Where do they come from?
I mean,
what are the forces that are transforming them?
Well, how will they be built? I mean, if you can't.
Oh, you're talking about what alternative institutions will be built.
Right.
Well, I see. I'm sorry, I missed the point. I think, increasingly what you're going to see is you're going to see something comparable to the 60s emerging in the United States on campuses, because there's only so, these students can only be pushed so far. And it doesn't work to simply, you know, spray them with mace all the time. You know, or to arrest them, or to, you know, treat them as if they're infantile children who are somehow simply indulging in the worst of narcissistic behavior. I mean, students will be organizing. I mean, it's going to get worse. If the Republicans win the Senate, which, you know, as you well know, there's a good chance that they might, I can't even imagine what will happen to higher education in the United States. And at some point, it seems to me, a threshold is reached in which there's going to be enormous battles at all levels of education, because that's the one place left where students still have the possibility to mobilize and to organize. And so I think it's just a matter of time.
All right. Well, Henry Giroux, we will put up a link to your website, henryagiroux.com, author of The Spectacle, Zombies and the...
Cam, the real book, the book that has just come out, which we're talking about, is called Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education.
Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education. We have that linked at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. We're going to... I don't know. I got that echo there. We're going to take a break. Oh, we should also note that we're happy to have an in-studio audience today.
Indeed.
Adam Baum from a frequent IMer, but perhaps even more prestigiously known as the curator of
Majority.geekwonk.com.
Yes, where you can get a links to just about everything we talk about in the show and more. And as soon as I figure out a way of putting a sort of standing link on our menu on the front page of majority.fm, you'll get there. But obviously, you can just go to the Daily Post, and there's always a link there.
And let me just say really quick, just as a quick plug for how good a job he does on this. So I know a lot of people, including myself, I wasn't surprised by the Walt Disney FBI thing. But that was a bit of a non sequitur to me. I thought he might have reached for a more commonly understood, undeniable fact. As soon as you go on majority.geekwonk.com, yes, Walt Disney was an FBI informant, and the link is there.
Bingo.
Got it like that.
Wow.
No problem.
It's
Boom.
Like the perfect companion to the show.
Well, I was almost, I was wondering, like, why does he need the internet connection? We're sitting here, and now we know, because he's constantly.
He's working.
He's working it on the move. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. We will come back into the funner half, wherein maybe you will hear the sound of Adam Baum's voice. It may, well, he's a little mic shy.
I think he is. Can I say I like Adam Baum? I get it. I always wish it was Adam Bong. Maybe that's my inner Jimmy Reaper cake.
Also on the program, supposedly this guy on Twitter who's going to school me is going to call in. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. You know, Henry Giroux spoke about the importance.
That was Henry Giroux. It's already done.
Yeah, he schooled me. Yeah. And now this other guy is going to school me. He's giving me pro tips.
I do have to ask Adam Baum a question really quick. Is your name any relation to the former WWF wrestler?
Here you go. You can pick it up.
Not a chance. Sorry about
that.
There you go.
Auspicious first line on the show. Not a chance.
Not a chance. Coming up, we will hear also from... Colonel Alan West, retired, who is now a Fox contributor. He's going to tell Sean Hannity that President Obama is at fault for Fort Hood because evil and then Crimea, I think, are the two reasons. All that and more coming up. And, I'm also going to attempt to read part of, is it David Koch's? Was it David Koch or Charles?
Charles Koch's.
Op-ed in the Washington, in Wall Street Journal, of course. I'm going to try and read portions of that in the voice of Jimmy Stewart, just because, you know.
Things have changed a lot, say.
Oh, wow. You just brought that up.
Maybe Michael should do it.
I guess. See, Michael, this is what Michael does during the whole show, is he, while he's pretending to listen to the show, he's actually studying tapes from It's a Beautiful Life. And
it's a Wonderful Life.
Wonderful Life. And then he can come on.
I like the concept. Execution, not so great.
Mary? All right, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. Folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. If you buy crap from Amazon, the very least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. We get a kickback. You will notice no difference, but we get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back. You can IM us at Majority FM.
And I feel